Hello and welcome to the December 2nd, 2025 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief. I hope listeners in the U.S. enjoyed the recent Thanksgiving holiday with family and friends. Despite the chaos of current times, I hope we can all find things to be thankful for. Among the things I'm grateful for is the opportunity to be here to let you know about the new articles you'll find if you go to annals.org. In some locations where recreational cannabis is legal, cannabis dispensaries seem to be as common as coffee shops, and cannabis use can lead to adverse events requiring emergency department visits. The authors of the first study I'll mention wanted to see whether exposure to cannabis retail stores is associated with neighborhood-level rates of cannabis-related emergency department visits. They studied data from 6,140,595 residents in Ontario, Canada, aged 15 to 105 years old, residing in 10,574 neighborhoods between April 2017 and December 2022. They leveraged provincial data on cannabis store locations to define neighborhoods as exposed, meaning within 1,000 meters of a cannabis retail store, or unexposed, more than 1,000 meters from a cannabis retail store. The primary health outcome was the neighborhood level of cannabis-attributable emergency department visits per 100,000 persons aged 15 years or older. They found that exposed neighborhoods were more likely to be in large urban centers and the lowest income quintile compared to unexposed neighborhoods. Relative to unexposed neighborhoods, the absolute rate of cannabis-attributable emergency department visits increased by 12% in exposed neighborhoods. There is also evidence that having more cannabis stores within 1,000 meters correlated to a larger increase in rates of cannabis-attributable emergency department visits. The researchers think that these findings suggest that restrictions on the overall number of cannabis retail stores or store concentrations or on being located in certain areas might offer public health benefits. In a new policy position statement, the American College of Physicians says that managed care strategies employed by insurance plans should have the goal of improving health outcomes for patients rather than focusing solely on conserving costs. The ACP offers recommendations to protect the patient-physician relationship, prevent inappropriate restrictions on access to care, ensure that the primary goal of managed care is to improve health outcomes, not just to reduce costs. The recommendations include streamlining payments and administrative processes and providing physicians with means to more effectively advocate on behalf of patients. ACP says that evidence-based standards and current guidelines should inform utilization management's decisions. Plans should maintain transparency and ensure patients can access equitable, high-value, medically necessary care in a timely manner. The position paper concludes that plans must collaborate with patient advocacy organizations, physician associations, policymakers, and other key entities to ensure that the top priority is the mutual goal of connecting patients to high-value, evidence-based care. The next article reports a cluster randomized trial that compared different advanced care planning approaches for adults with serious illness. The trial found that implementing a patient-facing automated advanced care planning intervention coupled with clinician training and mailed materials within health systems increases documentation of a plan within the electronic health record and is further enhanced with patient navigator outreach. Advanced care planning involves clarifying patient values and goals and documenting these within the electronic health record to guide future care. However, advanced care planning is often not implemented. In the study reported here, researchers compared three advanced care planning interventions among 8,707 seriously ill adult primary care patients across 50 primary care clinics at three University of California institutions. 5,810 of these patients did not have a documented advanced care plan. Clinics were randomly assigned to one of three intervention groups. Group 1 received messages through the electronic health record patient portal, with a link to an advanced directive form and a mailed message. Group 2 included the same materials as Group 1, plus a link to the prepareforyourcare.org website and a mail prepare pamphlet. Group 3 received everything that Groups 1 and 2 received, plus outreach by a health navigator. At 24 months, Group 3 patients were most likely to have a documented advanced care plan compared to Group 1 and Group 2, who did not differ from each other, but had more plans than they did at baseline. However, even in group 3, only 39% of patients had a documented plan. The researchers note that the interventions they examined were feasible within existing clinical workflows and can be adjusted for desired intervention frequency and might serve as a foundation for more intensive interventions. Studies of corticosteroid treatment of patients with pneumonia have conflicting results, and there is concern that corticosteroids might increase complications. Next is a systematic review and meta-analysis that evaluated the association between corticosteroid therapy, mortality, and infectious complications in adults with severe non-COVID-19 pneumonia. Researchers analyzed 20 randomized controlled trials comprising 3,459 participants that compared systemic corticosteroids with placebo or usual care. The primary analysis included studies using corticosteroids at 3 mg per kilogram or less per day for 15 days or less, initiated within 7 days of pneumonia or acute respiratory distress syndrome onset. The researchers found that adjunct corticosteroids probably reduced short-term mortality in both severe pneumonia and ARDS, but evidence for their effect on long-term mortality remains uncertain. The findings suggest that there is no evidence of increased complications with corticosteroid use for patients with non-COVID-19 pneumonia, which is one of the main concerns regarding corticosteroid use in this setting. In an opinion piece published in Annals of Internal Medicine, Dr. Sue Bornstein reflects on the decades-long history of gun violence in America and offers recommendations and resources for physicians to use when addressing gun violence with their patients. Dr. Bornstein refers to the American College of Physicians' stance that physicians should counsel their patients about mitigating the risks associated with firearms in the home and share solutions to common barriers physicians say prevent them from counseling patients on firearm safety. These barriers include lack of time in the clinical encounter, concerns about offending patients, lack of familiarity with guns, and legal protections for healthcare professionals. Since there is no clear consensus on whether universal or risk-based screening for firearm injury risk is preferable, she recommends to use the approach that best aligns with the practice setting and reminds us that physicians have an ethical duty to prevent firearm-associated harm. Also new on Annals.org is a History of Medicine article that describes the origin of the American Tuberculosis Sanitarium Movement in Asheville, North Carolina. And the last new article I'll highlight is an Ideas and Opinions essay that argues that the massive and growing amount of health-related data available in current times is leading to more publications, but not necessarily better science. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and I encourage you to go to annals.org for the new material I've mentioned here and previously published articles that you may have missed. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.